garlic and the fat boy blues. Rice and beans and sauce.
The protesters have a huge problem. They're no longer protesting. They're impeding justice. Protesting is standing off to the side and not interfering.
What MAGA backers think about Minneapolis after the shooting and killing of two protesters by federal agents.
It's Wednesday, January 28th, and this is All Things Considered from NPR News.
I'm Scott Detrow.
And I'm Mary Louise Kelly. Amazon is laying off 16,000 workers. The move comes just months after the company ended 14,000 other jobs.
There's a lot of pressure on those companies to make cuts based on the investments that they've made.
Plus, the Federal Reserve holds interest rates steady despite political pressure from the White House.
And how musician Michael Mayo taps into the long history of jazz while still creating new distinct sounds.
For me, an underlying part of the spirit of jazz is the spirit of curiosity, play, exploration, freedom.
First News.
Live from NPR News in Washington, I'm Ryland Barton. Three more employees at the U.S. Attorney's Office in Minnesota have quit. The resignations are in addition to the at least six prosecutors who quit earlier this month after the Justice Department pressured them to investigate the widow of a woman killed by an ICE agent. NPR's Ryan Lucas reports.
The three new resignations at the U.S. Attorney's Office in Minnesota include a division chief. The departures add to the already significant exodus of veteran attorneys from the office there in recent weeks. They come as the Trump administration continues its ramped-up immigration enforcement operation in Minneapolis, where federal agents have shot and killed two U.S. citizens this month, Renee Macklin Good and Alex Preddy. At least six federal prosecutors in the U.S. Attorney's Office there recently quit after the Justice Department pressured them to investigate Good's widow. Meanwhile, an FBI agent who tried to investigate Good's killing resigned last week after being pressured to drop the matter. Ryan Lucas, NPR News, Washington.
Many Nashville residents are going on their fourth day with no heat after a winter storm knocked out power to half the city's residents. People there are helping each other to stay warm as freezing temperatures continue. Justin Barney at member station WPLN reports.
Getting a hot meal in Nashville has been tough. Most restaurants are closed and over 100,000 people have gone days without power. Melissa Bruner drove 2.5 hours down from Kentucky to set up shop in a Kroger parking lot. She's giving away free hot meals with the help of World Central Kitchen.
Hi, sweetie. How many's in your group?
Four.
Us four.
Thank you. You're welcome. You. When things like this happen, you need to get out and help people.
With hotel rooms booked up, many Nashvillians are relying on friends and family for warm places to stay. For NPR News, I'm Justin Barney.
The Federal Reserve voted today to keep its benchmark interest rate unchanged. NPR's Scott Horsley reports the decision affects borrowing costs for both businesses and families.
The central bank had cut interest rates at its last three meetings in an effort to prop up the sagging job market. But with inflation still well above the Fed's 2% target, policymakers opted to stand pat today. The vote was 10-2, with Fed Governors Chris Waller and Stephen Miron dissenting in favor of another quarter-point rate cut. The Fed's benchmark rate will stay in a range between 3.5% and 3.75%, just as financial markets had expected. President Trump has been demanding lower interest rates, even though the central bank's designed to be insulated from that kind of political pressure. Trump is expected to nominate a new chairman of the Federal Reserve soon to replace Jerome Powell, whose term expires in May. Scott Horsley, NPR News, Washington.
Amazon is cutting about 16,000 jobs in the latest round of tech industry layoffs. The reductions follow October's layoffs of about 14,000 workers. U.S.-based staff will have 90 days to find a new role internally. Those unsuccessful or uninterested will receive severance pay and health insurance. This is NPR News from Washington. Iran is reaching out to Middle Eastern countries over the threat of a possible U.S. military strike. Saudi Arabia and the United Arab Emirates have signaled they won't allow their airspace to be used for any attack. The U.S. has moved an aircraft carrier into the region, and President Trump has urged Iran to negotiate. Social media influencers are among those reacting to the immigration crackdown in Minneapolis and the shooting of Alex Preddy by federal agents last weekend. That includes some accounts that have nothing to do with news or politics. NPR's Elizabeth Blair reports.
For her 232,000 followers on Instagram, Dylan Mansour creates funny voiceover videos featuring her adorable Australian shepherd, Artemis. But this week, she broke with her regular content to talk about the violence in Minneapolis.
This account is not going to become a
personal political account, but I cannot stay silent with what is happening in the world today.
There's an account featuring portraits of American Girl dolls, and now some of them are captioned with anti-ICE images. Anand Pandian is an anthropology professor at Johns Hopkins University and the author of Something Between Us, The Everyday Walls of American Life and How to Take Them Down.
I think a lot of people have the sense now that they have to stand up and say something.
Elizabeth Blair, NPR News.
The TV drama Heated Rivalry has gained unexpected popularity in Russia, despite the country's anti-LGBTQ plus laws. The show is about a secret gay relationship between Canadian and Russian hockey players. Restrictions limit access to such content, but Russians are finding ways to watch it illegally. U.S. stock indexes closed largely flat today. This is NPR News.
Support for NPR comes from NPR stations. Other contributors include Imaginable Futures, funding programs in the U.S. with the goal of ensuring young children and their parents get the education they need to thrive. Learn more at ImaginableFutures.com. This is NPR.
Good afternoon, it's 4:06, and you're listening to All Things Considered. It's here on People Powered KAXC. National Public Radio reporting next on the Maryland Eastern Shore to hear what supporters of President Trump think about the killing of Alex Preti by federal agents in Minneapolis. You can find local reporting from the award-winning KEXC newsroom, including a vigil last night at a Mexican restaurant in downtown Brainerd. That's coming up at 5:30.
Considered from NPR News, I'm Scott Detrow.
And I'm Mary Louise Kelly. The killing of Alex Preti by federal agents in Minneapolis last Saturday has enraged people across the country. We wanted to know what supporters of President Trump's immigration policy think about the shooting. So NPR's Frank Langfitt hit the road to find out.
I'm on the Chesapeake Bay Bridge on my way to Maryland's Eastern Shore and heading to Caroline County. And in 2024, people there voted for President Trump more than 2-1.
AJ Lawrence, Alistair, if you must.
Alistair Lawrence is redoing the attic of a house here in Denton. It's a rural town of about 5,000. He sides with the federal officers who shot Preti and blames protesters in Minneapolis for the conflict on the streets.
The protesters have a huge problem. They're no longer protesting. They're impeding justice. Protesting is standing off to the side and not interfering. ICE is here to do their job by order of the president. Regardless if you like him or not, you live in this country, he is your president.
Preti was videotaping the agents who work with U.S. Customs and Border Protection. Then he helped a woman after one shoved her to the ground. Lawrence says Preti should have stayed out of it, especially since the agents were armed.
They've been put in other situations where their life has been at stake. So yeah, they're probably on edge. They're probably a little jumpy.
Preti is the second U.S. citizen killed this month following the death of Renee Macklin Good. Neither killing changes Lawrence's support for broad immigration enforcement. He says he has personal experience with it. A family member from England ran afoul of U.S. immigration law years ago.
My mom.
Is she English?
She is. She was married here, and after 9/11, her paperwork wasn't up to date. So she got banned from the country.
She got deported?
She got deported.
Was that fair?
At the end of the day, yeah, she didn't have her paperwork in line. You know, like, paperwork's important. It's why we have it.
Two blocks away, I run into Jennifer Barrow outside the courthouse. She's less focused on the safety of protesters and more concerned about immigrants committing violent crime.
I have a 12-year-old daughter, and if I were to happen to witness my daughter being raped by an illegal immigrant that has committed crimes over and over and over again and not being deported, like, that's not okay.
How many illegal immigrants are raping people in America? Do you know?
I don't know the number, but I do hear the stories very often about whether it's raping or murdering.
There have been heavily publicized cases of immigrants committing violent crime. In 2024, an undocumented Venezuelan man killed Lakin Riley, a Georgia nursing student. However, research shows undocumented immigrants are less likely to be convicted or incarcerated for crimes than U.S.-born citizens. I spoke with about 24 people in Denton yesterday. Many said they hadn't seen videos of Preti's killing and didn't know much about it. Destiny O'Neill works at a restaurant in town. She gets a lot of her information from social media. The resulting algorithms don't deliver much news.
I like cosmetics, beauty, Tubi movies and stuff like that. I go to my phone to like escape my world.
Do you follow any news sources or just curious?
No, not really, no.
A block down the street from the restaurant, Jeff Wright is chipping ice off the sidewalk. He thinks both Preddy and the Border Protection agents made mistakes.
He shouldn't have been carrying a gun in that situation, even though he has a permit to do so. I think it was stupid to be in a situation where there's ICE people there. Did I want him to see him get killed? No.
After chatting with Wright, I began to walk away. And then I remembered a question about Trump's deputy chief of staff and the head of Homeland Security.
Do you remember that Stephen Miller said this guy was a would-be assassin and Chrissy Nunn said he was a domestic terrorist?
What'd you think? they probably speak too soon. They need to do the research a little bit more.
Did it bother you that they said that about
him? Probably, a little bit. They should have waited.
Why do you think they said that?
They're doing what their base wants to hear.
Preddy was an intensive care nurse. He worked at a VA hospital, looking after people who have defended the United States. Frank Langford, NPR News, Denton, Maryland.
Today, Amazon told about 16,000 white-collar employees that they will soon be out of a job. They laid off 14,000 in October, and taken together, it is the largest layoff in the e-commerce giant's history. And it comes in the midst of a dramatic shift in the tech industry, from a talent war to the artificial intelligence race. From member station KUOW in Seattle, Monica Nicholsberg reports.
When Matt McLean joined Amazon in 2020, it was a different time. The pandemic drove millions of people out of brick-and-mortar stores and onto websites like Amazon. McLean's job was to predict how many employees the company would need to handle all of that growth.
When you're in a period of massive growth, it takes a lot more people to make that happen.
A lot more. In 5 years, Amazon roughly doubled its headcount from about 800,000 to 1.6 million. Then the company's growth slowed coming out of the pandemic. It went through several big rounds of layoffs. And in October, McLean ended up on the chopping block.
I was one of the 14,000 that were informed that there was no longer a need to show up for work.
Amazon says these cuts are necessary to correct for overhiring during the pandemic, right-sizing in corporate speak. In an interview last week with the tech and finance publication The Information, Amazon CEO Andy Jassy said the company got too bloated.
We added a lot of people. And when you add a lot of people in a short period of time, you almost always choose to organize with a lot of different layers and managers.
He says that bureaucracy was making Amazon inefficient.
You know, you've got the pre-meeting for the pre-meeting for the meeting. People don't show up with recommendations anymore because they know that the decision is going to get made 3 meetings later.
It may also be that the AI race is influencing Amazon's headcount decisions. Where at one time tech companies were vying to pay for talent, they're now fighting to outspend each other on multi-billion-dollar data center projects, which means trimming back elsewhere.
There's a lot of pressure on those companies to make cuts based on the investments that they've made.
Andy Challenger is with the business coaching firm Challenger, Gray & Christmas. It helps companies and employees navigate layoffs and conducts labor market research.
Whether they're really replacing jobs with artificial intelligence today, I think is a lot less clear.
Jassy has said publicly that the layoffs aren't related to AI, but two senior Amazon employees say managers now expect them to use AI to pick up the slack when their teams shrink. They spoke to NPR on the condition of anonymity because they're worried about losing their jobs. They say managers now use a dashboard to track how often employees are using those AI tools, and they expect AI usage to be factored in during performance reviews. A spokesperson for Amazon refuted that, saying leadership does not instruct managers to include AI usage in evaluations. Here's Challenger again.
I think there's a lot of pressure on those companies to show that they have been able to replace some work with technology.
In Amazon's hometown of Seattle, layoffs at Amazon, Microsoft, and other tech companies have driven the unemployment rate in the metro area to 5.1%, well above the national jobless rate. And Challenger expects more layoffs in the tech industry this year. Since being laid off in October, McLean has been focused on finding his next gig. He's still looking.
I really am grateful for the time that I had at Amazon. The leadership principles will forever change the way I operate, not just in work, but in life. I'm sad to see it over.
For NPR News, I'm Monica Nicholsberg in Seattle.
a beloved behind-the-scenes figure from the University of Alabama's athletic program has died. Eddie Conyers spent more than 60 years as a referee at Crimson Tide football practices, working under such legendary coaches as Bear Bryant and Nick Saban. He was 97 years old. NPR's Debbie Elliott has this remembrance.
Even up until last season, you'd find Eddie Conyers roaming the sidelines of Bama football practice in his black and white striped officials jersey.
Hey, where's my flag?
He'd thrown that flag on some of football's biggest names. Think Joe Namath, Kenny Stabler, Jalen Hurts, and Derrick Henry. The practice ref is a role he helped pioneer after being recruited by Coach Paul Bear Bryant more than six decades ago. Here's what he told NPR last fall.
And I remember I asked Coach Bryant, what do you want me to do? I didn't have a clue. And Coach Bryant talked low and he mumbled. He said something like, I'm going to go watch the goddamn black goddamn. Well, I didn't have a clue what he said. And I just said, okay.
Quick with a joke or a story that might be half true, Conyers brought levity into the grueling full contact practice sessions. At one practice last year, he was greeted like a celebrity by Mark Ingram, Alabama's first Heisman winner and former NFL running back who's now a TV sports analyst.
You know what you mean to us. You know what you mean to us down here. You're the legend. You the GOAT, man.
At the time, Ingram told NPR that Conyers made an impression on players like him.
Happy, always joyful, made all of us happy to see him.
There was never a time that you saw Eddie that you didn't smile.
That's Jeff Allen, the head athletic trainer and director of sports medicine at Alabama, reacting to Conyers' death.
I can't think of a day in the 19 years that I was around him that he was having a bad day. I mean, he was a remarkable human being.
Allen says Conyers was a link to the storied history of Alabama's football program.
You know, there's a saying that they use here at the University of Alabama. It's a place where legends are made. And Eddie walked among a lot of legends, but not only did he walk among them, he was one of them. And that's what is going to be dearly missed.
Conyers was there for 12 of Alabama's college national football championships, and he loved every minute of it.
Unbelievable. Unimaginable. It's very nostalgic of going.
Eddie Conyers died Tuesday in Tuscaloosa. Debbie Elliott, NPR News.
Listening to All Things Considered from NPR News.
It's 4:18. We've got a connection to nature for you coming up next. John Latimer and our daily dose of phenology. I'm Heidi Holton. Thanks for tuning in today. Looking at the weather, it's going to be another cold white night across northern Minnesota. That means temperatures anywhere from 15 to 18 below, with wind chill values between 15 and 30 below. Chance of flurries tomorrow, mostly cloudy and cold with highs 0 to 6 degrees and evening lows from 10 to 20 below zero.
On today's date, January 28th in the year 2000, I come across the tracks of a deer mouse and I follow it for a bit and I discover that it has climbed up a small shrub and put a top on what appears to be perhaps a chestnut-sided warbler's nest. And it's living in there, or at least it's storing food in there. I can see by looking inside that it has created some kind of a storage unit there where it is keeping some chow. And this is entirely natural for the deer mouse. They are, in fact, arboreal mice. They climb trees as well as they scamper across the ground. The one problem with deer mice is that they are one of the vectors for deer ticks. And the baby deer ticks need a meal before they can become adult deer ticks and make a meal of us. but they get that meal oftentimes at the expense of the deer mouse or his cousin, the white-footed mouse. So as you're wandering about this winter, if you come across a little bird's nest with a cover on it, look inside. You may find a deer mouse.
Support for NPR comes from the station. And from Charles Schwab, offering investors choices like full-service wealth management, advice, investing, and trading on Thinkorswim. Learn more at schwab.com. From the Robert Wood Johnson Foundation, RWJF is a national philanthropy working toward a future where health is no longer a privilege, but a right. Learn more at rwjf.org. And from the sustaining members of this NPR station.
It's All Things Considered from NPR News. I'm Scott Detrow.
And I'm Elsa Chang. Our first-time Grammy nominee series continues today with the jazz singer and musician Michael Mayo. We met him at his dad's recording studio in Pasadena.
Oh, my God! You guys look alike!
Yeah, Michael is standing right next to his dad, Scott Mayo. And not only do they look alike, everyone in this family also shares loads of musical talent. Michael says his mom, Valerie Pinkston, used to get him to come out of his room by singing operatically.
Oh, did you tell them
Am
that?
Am I wrong? Am I wrong?
You told them
yes.
That?
Okay, Valerie, I need to hear you call Michael out of his room now. Sing
I don't
it.
Remember.
Wow!
And so, of course, on Michael's Grammy-nominated album, Fly, you get to hear the whole family sing together.
Basically, all the vocals for the title track, Fly, were recorded here. My dad recorded the saxophone melody here.
There's just a family connection. We almost never talked about where we were going to breathe, where we're going to cut off a note. We just did it, and it was just tight.
When we were doing Fly, It took us forever because all we did was laugh. We were laughing throughout. It was so much fun. And then,
see, that is, I am so envious because I can imagine if I collaborated with my family on anything, you'd be hearing the sound of arguing the whole time. Because he grew up in such a musical family, it may not be surprising that Michael went down this path. But I asked him when he knew that jazz would be his calling.
I think I was actually 13. That summer before I started high school, my granny, my mom's mom, gave me a best of Ella Fitzgerald collection. It was like 150 of Ella's greatest recordings. Uh-huh. And then my dad gave me Kind of Blue by Miles Davis. Yeah. And so I just like went from not knowing anything about jazz to just having an influx of so much, and I fell in love immediately.
God, I didn't know quite what I was interested in when I was 13, 14.
Hmm.
So I want to talk about your voice.
Hmm.
You are an insane vocalist. Like, you have such incredible voice control. What was it about singing, about using your voice as an instrument that you were so drawn to?
In my family, singing is kind of a mode of communication. And you guys might have already heard it, but in the way that me and my parents talk to each other, there's a lot of sort of sing-songy vibes in there.
Yes.
And so it just has always felt very natural in the sense of, like, it's a natural instinct to sing. There's something about vocal expression that to me feels very human and very sort of innate. It's like, I think singing and dancing are two of the most fundamental parts of being human.
Mm-hmm.
And for me, that tends to be what it's about.
Of the wonderful things that you get in a life, there are four. Now there may not be many, but nobody needs any more.
Well, I want to talk specifically about the song Four, which is the song that you got the Grammy nomination for Best Jazz Performance. It's a Miles Davis tune that became kind of a jazz standard. It's a song that's like 70 years old at this point, yeah?
Wow.
When you put them together, you know what the last one must be.
as a 30-something-year-old, how much do you think about your relationship to the jazz greats of the past or the standard repertoire of jazz music?
Yeah. I think the longer I spend time with this music, the stronger the feeling of connection is. For me, an underlying part of the spirit of jazz is the spirit of curiosity, play, exploration, freedom, right? Mm-hmm. And so while I do think that it's important to respect and learn the tradition, I do think that we kind of do ourselves a disservice if we like are only playing in ways that have happened before, because that goes against the vision that people like Miles Davis, Louis Armstrong, all these people had, right? The forward-thinking nature of it all, I think, is part of the thing.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
They were trying to push against limits.
Exactly.
And so are there ways in which you consciously, as an artist, try to modernize jazz singing styles to push forward in a similar way that past jazz greats did?
Consciously, unconsciously. It's like kind of somewhere in the middle, because I'm not like literally sitting at a notebook and writing, here are the ways that I'm going to revolutionize jazz. You know what I mean? Like, I'm not actually doing that. For me, it's just, it's like the more I allow myself to lead with authenticity and actually just like genuine self-expression, the more I find people saying things like, you're innovating. Which is like not necessarily the goal. Like for me, it's more just like, I'm gonna make the musical statements that feel the most natural.
So we were looking around at interviews you'd done in the past, and we found this article from, I think it was like a decade ago when you were still at UCLA studying jazz. And in this article, let's see if you recognize this, you say, quote, jazz is, aside from being one of the most American art forms that there is, jazz is an allegory to life. Mm-hmm. First of all, I was like, you talk like that in your 20s? You use words like allegory?
I did. I did.
But what I really want to ask you is, does that still ring true for you? Does jazz feel like an allegory?
It does. Mm-hmm. No, it really does. I mean, I think there's so many principles of working together and cohabitating and, you know, unity that really are put on full display when playing jazz and when experiencing jazz. A lot of the things that we value in this music are things that, like, I think that we kind of should value as humans, as like civilizations, right? And all these things, like I was saying earlier, curiosity, play, exploration, freedom, self-expression, welcoming in others, listening, responding, all these things are just so beautiful and important, and I think like should be modeled. And I learned a lot of that in jazz.
Jazz musician Michael Mayo, thank you so much, and congratulations on your 2 Grammy nominations.
Oh my God, thank you so much. I am over the moon about it, truly.
Before we go, Michael sits down at the piano and treats us to a performance of his song, Bag of Bones.
Bag of bones, homeward bound, unmotivated. Look around, you find your home in a bag of bones. A tethered mind is a sign of life worth living now.
And tomorrow, we continue our series on first-time Grammy nominees with the artist Destin Conrad on All Things Considered.
You eat, you sleep.
This is NPR News.
It's 4:29. Coming up, we've got National Native News. We're learning today about a new language immersion program sweeping across northern Alaska. Then it's more news from All Things Considered. I'm Heidi Holt, and thanks for tuning in today. If you rely on KEXE and you are at least 70 and a half years old, you can support KEXE's future in an easy way. Ask your financial advisor to set up charitable IRA distributions to KEXE. If you have questions, call Sarah, 218-326-1000. 1234. And we receive support from ICTV. Stay tuned, stay connected with ICTV. Learn more at watchictv.org. Looking at the weather tonight, 14 to 18 below zero. Wind chill values between 15 and 30 below. Chance of flurries tomorrow, mostly cloudy and cold, 0 to 6 degrees. The Minnesota DNR hosts a public meeting at 6 o'clock tonight in Aiken at the Aiken Public Library about changes to the public waters inventory list.
This is National Native News. I'm Antonia Gonzalez. From a Wordle game to a new language immersion program, a wave of efforts to revitalize the Inupiaq language has been sweeping across northern Alaska. Last month, an artist received an award to create a native language workbook for kids. Ayolna Niden with the Alaska Desk has more.
Elena Bengston has loved making art since she was a child. Now that she has a child of her own, she wants to use her art to help him learn the Inupiaq language. Bengston is an Utqiagvik artist who recently received the Rasmussen Award to create a workbook that will do just that. She will spend a year designing and illustrating a primer for children that teaches the Inupiaq alphabet and numbers. Bengston says her four-year-old son, Kahaliyauk, was her inspiration for the project.
It all kind of started with creating for him and being able to use those resources.
Bengston says she's still on her own language learning journey. She practices speaking with elders and uses dictionaries and the Rosetta Stone app. But Bengston says children learn differently than adults, and she wanted to create educational materials that cater to the youngest learners.
You start kindergarten, you have the whole workbook, you're learning the alphabet, the numbers, the colors, and we have all that in English, but I'm like, what if we had that in Inupiaq?
Bengston says some resources for learning in Inupiaq are available through the North Sloboro School District, but she says regular parents might not have access to them.
It's really born out of necessity. I'm sure there are resources out there, but they're not something you could just go pick up at the store or buy online.
Bengston's project is just one example of the language revitalization efforts in the region. 2 years ago, the school district restarted its Inupiaq immersion program. And a few years before that, Alaska Native linguists created a digital Inupiaq dictionary. And when the popular puzzle game Wordle took off across the country, local linguists and enthusiasts created an Inupiaq version.
We've been making big strides recently. You know, with the history of it, it's definitely a dying language, but I think it's important we keep it alive.
Bengston says everyone can do their part to preserve the language. And the workbook is just one step for her. In Anchorage, I am Alona Niden.
A former Navajo Nation poet laureate has been named by Arizona Governor Katie Hobbs as the state's second ever state poet. KJZZ's Gabriel Pietrazio has more.
Laura Tohe has dedicated her life to Indigenous literature, but doesn't want that identity to dominate her tenure.
I don't want people to think that, you know, I'm just, again, shifting from Navajo Nation to Arizona as a Navajo poet.
And part of her pledge is to help bring poetry to rural communities. While most living on the Navajo Nation have no choice but to haul essentials like water, coal, and wood from far away, for Tohe growing up, it was books.
I did.
Born in Fort Defiance, Arizona, Tohe remembers taking long road trips with her mother to the closest library across state lines in New Mexico.
We did make it to Gallup, and I got a library card. She wanted to make sure I had access.
For National Native News, I'm Gabriel Pietrazio.
The U.S. Senate Committee on Indian Affairs is holding a hearing Wednesday in Washington, D.C., focusing on Native children. The hearing will examine the draft Native Children's Commission Implementation Act, which focuses on improving justice and safety outcomes for Native children. It includes tribal-federal coordination on public safety, juvenile justice, and victim services. The hearing will be streamed on the committee's website. I'm Antonia Gonzalez.
National Native News is produced by Kawanak Broadcast Corporation with funding by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting.
Support for law and justice-related programming provided by Hobbs Strauss Dean & Walker, LLP, a national law firm dedicated to promoting and defending tribal rights for over 40 years. More information available at HobbsStrauss.com.
Hear that? Tribal college faculty do so much. One can't say it all here. Nothing but respect. Visit mosttheorjobdescription.com. The American Indian College Fund supports this program.
Native Voice One, the Native American Radio Network.
And from BritBox, dedicated to offering viewers the opportunity to see it differently with British TV. Streaming original series, Jane Austen dramas, Agatha Christie mysteries, and more at BritBox.com. From Procter & Gamble, maker of ZQuil, with a range of products designed to relieve occasional sleeplessness to help people fall asleep. Learn more at ZQuil.com. And from the listeners who support this NPR station.
It's All Things Considered from NPR News. I'm Scott Detrow.
And I'm Mary Louise Kelly. The Federal Reserve held interest rates steady this afternoon. That was expected. President Trump has been waging a high-pressure campaign to get the central bank to cut rates more aggressively. But with inflation still elevated, the Fed is moving cautiously. NPR's Scott Horsley has been covering this. He is here now. Hi, Scott.
Hi, Mary Louise.
So the Fed did cut interest rates. I'm thinking at its last three meetings. Is that right? Why they sit tight today?
Yeah, well, the Fed's twin enemies are unemployment and inflation. And they did cut rates in September, October, and December because they were really worried about the weakening job market. You know, hiring slowed down. Surveys show people are nervous about being able to find a job if they have to. And that was kind of outweighing their worries about inflation during the fall. But now the Fed says there's some signs the job market is stabilizing, so they're back to looking at inflation, which, although it's not as high as it was a few years ago, is still higher than the Fed would like. And Fed Chairman Jerome Powell says a lot of what's driving inflation these days is President Trump's tariffs.
The expectation is that we will see the effects of tariffs flowing through goods prices, peaking, and then starting to come down, assuming there are no new major tariff increases that are begun.
And if inflation does moderate, the Fed might be able to start cutting interest rates again. Now, two members of the rate-setting committee wanted to cut rates today, Fed Governors Chris Waller and Stephen Miron, but they were outvoted by their colleagues.
Back to President Trump, who, as we know, wants lower borrowing costs. He has gone to great lengths to try to bend the Fed in that direction. Is it working?
Not really. You know, Trump installed Miron on the Fed board last September, and he's been steadily lobbying his colleagues for bigger rate cuts, but he hasn't been very persuasive so far. Trump also tried to fire Fed Governor Lisa Cook, which would have opened the door to install another more aggressive rate cutter. But so far, the courts have said Cook can keep her job, at least for the time being. The Supreme Court actually heard arguments last week in that case, which is testing how much authority the president can exercise over the central bank. Treasury Secretary Scott Bessent criticized Jerome Powell for attending that hearing, but Powell said it was important that he be there.
That case is perhaps the most important legal case in the Fed's 113-year history. And I thought it might be hard to explain why I didn't attend.
Powell usually tries to steer clear of fights with the president, but he broke character earlier this month when the Justice Department served subpoenas on the Fed, supposedly over cost overruns on its headquarters renovation. Powell said at the time that was just a pretext, that this was another way for the administration to pressure the Fed into lowering rates, and Powell insisted he and his colleagues won't be intimidated.
We do know that Jerome Powell is bumping up against the end of his tenure as Fed chairman. Do we know what's next for him?
You know, Powell's term as chairman ends in May, so he is likely to preside over just two more rate-setting meetings. The president is expected to nominate his successor pretty soon. That person's going to face some tough questions during their confirmation hearing about whether they will exercise independent judgment when it comes to setting interest rates or just do what the president wants. Powell was asked today what advice he'd offer the next Fed chairman. He said, you know, work with the great Fed staff, be responsive to Congress, and don't get dragged into political fights. Powell has not said whether he plans to stay on the Fed board after his term as Fed chairman expires, but he could continue to serve for another couple of years.
And Pierre Scott Horsley, thank you.
You're welcome.
The most playoff wins by a coach in NFL history, the most division titles, second most regular season wins of all time, and then there are six Super Bowl rings. Yes, I am talking about Bill Belichick, who paced the New England Patriots sideline in his ratty hoodies for decades. Love him or hate him, and I will say in full disclosure, I was always firmly in the latter camp. Belichick was the walking embodiment of a future Hall of Famer, and yet this week he was snubbed. Denied entry to football's Hall of Fame by the voting committee. So what is going on here? Dan Shaughnessy is here to answer that. He's a longtime sports columnist for the Boston Globe, the author of a number of books, all in all, somebody who knows a lot about the Patriots. Welcome to the show.
Hi, Scott. Good to be here.
What'd you make of this?
Well, I was surprised. I thought he would get in. I've kind of paid attention to this because the Patriot owner, Bob Kraft, he's on the same ballot that Bill was on, and those will be announced on Thursday, and we think Kraft's getting in. We thought Belichick was a slam dunk. And it's surprising, and it's kind of an embarrassment for the Pro Football Hall of Fame.
Yeah.
And this is a bad look because he's clearly a Hall of Fame coach. He will be in the Hall of Fame, but I guess they're punishing him and making him sit out a year or more.
I want to ask about that. I listed all the high points on his resume, but there are two pretty significant scandals, what the football world called Deflategate and Spygate, shady practices by the Patriots
sure.
team that they were penalized for. Do you think that was a factor here?
I do. I talked to people who the voting was done secretly after 50 of the voters gathered on Zoom. Talking to people who were in that call, there was more conversation about the scandals, the cheating, the punishments than they expected.
What do you personally make of that? Because this was litigated at the time. He paid a personal fine. The team was penalized pretty heavily. Everybody moved forward.
It feels petty and vindictive and taking measure against a guy that they didn't like or some guys didn't like getting beat by or whatever you want to call it.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, baseball has its Hall of Fame, and I'm a voter, and they have a character clause, character, sportsmanship, integrity, and we've taken that very seriously, and that's why you don't see Barry Bonds, Roger Clemens, guys who were PED guys or other folks who had issues have been kept out because of that. Football's not had that ever. O.J. Simpson's in the Pro Football Hall of Fame. I mean, do we need to say anything else? And he was in before the scandals, before the crimes, and then there was no push to get him out, and he's still there. So it's surprising. It's clear that Belichick has a Hall of Fame resume,
yeah.
and the Pro Football Hall of Fame has never applied standards other than what happened on the field.
Do you think this is, like, you see this a little bit with the Baseball Hall of Fame where one or two voters will not cast a ballot for somebody who's a slam dunk Hall of Famer because they think, we want to keep, you know, like, obviously that was broken at a certain point, but nobody should be
yeah.
a unanimous vote, like that type of thing. Do you think there was some gatekeeping, like, Belichick, you're going to be in, but wait a year?
I suppose. I mean, this guy's been kept out because of people, and most of them are media people, who were not treated well by him
mm-hmm.
for decades. I'm one of them.
You think that was a factor, though?
Oh, I do.
Yeah.
I think people being treated poorly, this is their chance. And none of them have come out to say, I didn't vote for him and here's why. But I think it probably 40 to 45 are veteran media people. And then you got a handful of Hall of Famers, I think Tony Dungy and Bill Polian and Dan Fouts. And then they were voters as well. But it's mostly longtime media people.
I mean, lastly, Patriots fans have some good distractions right now. The team's back in the Super Bowl. How is this landing with people in and around the franchise?
In and around the franchise is a good question, Scott, because there's a real rift between Bob Kraft, the owner, and Bill, the ex-coach. They've been sniping at one another for a couple of years now. Kraft putting out this hideous documentary, which presented as if there was no coach here the whole 20 years when they won all those Super Bowls. There ended up being a lot of competition for credit, deflection mm-hmm. of blame, jealousy, what have you. But the working relationship was not good at the end. Belichick was fired by Kraft. They don't like each other. Would have been super awkward to have them both on the stage in Canton, Ohio next summer, but that's not going to happen now.
That is Dan Shaughnessy with the Boston Globe. Thank you so much.
Thank you so much, Scott.
You're listening to All Things Considered. The U.S. Environmental Protection Agency has sent hundreds of millions of dollars to states so schools can test their water for lead. Exposure to lead has a bearing on children's health and development. But Molly Samuel from member station WABE in Atlanta reports that even with the testing paid for, some school districts are slow to take advantage of it.
Lead exposure can slow kids' development, according to the CDC. It can cause low IQs and make it hard for students to pay attention in school. One of the ways children can be exposed to lead is through drinking water, if it's flowing through lead pipes or fixtures. So when officials at Gwinnett County Public Schools in suburban Atlanta found out about the federal lead testing program...
Yeah, we went all in.
Patrick Burke manages operations at the district. With close to 180,000 students, Gwinnett is one of the biggest school systems in the country. The district decided to test more than 14,000 individual fixtures at all its schools.
So we had people coming in 2, 3 in the morning sometimes because we had to be here before our cafeteria started doing their work.
So we know this water does not have dangerous levels of lead in it.
This one's been tested, correct.
Yeah. This sink in an elementary school classroom used to also have a bubbler, one of those curved water fountain fixtures. When they did the testing, there was lead detected in the water coming out of it. So the district did a relatively quick and easy fix. They removed the problem bubbler.
Replacing those fixtures is a fairly low-cost way to help resolve a problem.
Kevin McUmber is the regional administrator for the US EPA in the Southeast. Nationwide, the EPA has distributed more than $200 million over the past several years. Here in Georgia, less than 1 in 4 public schools has enrolled in the program.
I'd love to see it go faster, but we're making progress, and that's what's important.
States can choose how to handle the funding. The state that's done far and away the most testing is North Carolina. That's in part because it's required by state law. In most other states, like here in Georgia, it's voluntary. Jennifer Hoppenick-Redman is with RTI International, a nonprofit that helps with the testing in Georgia. She says at first, her group had to do a lot of convincing to get school officials interested in the program.
Funding is one concern.
Because even if the testing is free, school leaders worry the fix could be expensive if it's more than just a problem faucet.
Another concern certainly is potential outcry.
Like, will there be negative media coverage, or will parents worry it's not a good place to send their kids? But Redman says recently there has been more interest among school leaders.
Not knowing whether there's lead in your drinking water or not does not mean it is not actually there. And I think our data have shown that it is pretty commonly found.
Redman says more than 90% of schools in Georgia that got tested had at least one fixture that exceeded the American Academy of Pediatrics guidelines for lead.
Once we find it, we can fix it.
And the EPA has changed how the money can be used. Now it can go toward fixes, too, not just testing for lead. Redman thinks that could make a difference for districts that had been hesitant. Patrick Burke with Gwinnett Schools says all their testing was worth it.
We can't do anything about the past. All we can do is do what's right about the future.
And that, he says, means doing what's right for kids. For NPR News, I'm Molly Samuel in Gwinnett County, Georgia.
You're listening to All Things Considered from NPR News.
It is 4:48. Thanks for tuning in. This is KAXE. I'm Heidi Holton. Another cold night tonight with 14 to 18 below zero and wind chill values between 15 and 30 below. Up next, at his first Senate Foreign Relations Committee hearing since Nicolas Maduro was seized, Secretary of State Marco Rubio warns the U.S. may use force to pressure Venezuela's administration. Tune in at 5:30 tonight. We've got the latest up north report coming from the KAXE newsroom. That includes stories on a protest, a vigil last night. Chelsea Perkins has that story. That was at a Mexican restaurant in downtown Brainerd, where 4 people were arrested yesterday. We're also hearing about a Red Lake Nation descendant that is facing federal assault charges after his encounter with Immigration and Customs Enforcement earlier this month. We receive support from Bemidji Brewing, located at 211 America Avenue in downtown Bemidji. Their new year starts with beer infusions and events like Tropical Escape Week, featuring live music and tiki glassware. More at BemidjiBeer.com. Bemidji Beer, nice catch. Want to remind you that precinct caucuses are meetings run by Minnesota's political parties. They're coming up Tuesday, February 3rd. That's next Tuesday at 7 p.m. They are the first in a series of meetings where parties may endorse candidates, select delegates, and state goals and values called party platforms. Statewide precinct caucuses are Tuesday, February 3rd, 7 p.m. You can find caucus locations at mnvotes.gov. Locations are set by the party, so you can also contact major parties for questions. Minnesota DNR has a public meeting coming up tonight at 6 o'clock at the Aiken Public Library. It is about proposed changes to the public waters inventory list.
From NPR News, this is All Things Considered. I'm Mary Louise Kelly.
And I'm Scott Detrow. Secretary of State Marco Rubio says it's not going to be all roses in Venezuela, but he insists that the Trump administration has made a lot of progress there after ousting President Nicolas Maduro in a military raid. NPR's Michelle Kellerman reports that Rubio faced some tough questions and a Senate hearing about what lies ahead.
Secretary Rubio says he's clear-eyed about Venezuela and taking it one step at a time.
We want to reach a phase of transition where we are left with a friendly, stable, prosperous Venezuela and democratic, in which all elements of society are represented in free and fair elections.
And he's urging senators on the Foreign Relations Committee, on which he once served as a Florida Republican, to be patient.
I get it. We all want like something immediately, but this is not a frozen dinner you put in a microwave and in 2.5 minutes it comes out ready to eat.
The Republican chairman of the committee, Jim Risch, says the Trump administration deserves credit for pulling off what he called an incredibly brief, targeted, and successful raid without any loss of American lives. That was less than 4 weeks ago. But the ranking Democrat, Jeanne Shaheen, questioned the cost of this adventurism.
The U.S. naval blockade around Venezuela and the raid have already cost American taxpayers hundreds of millions of dollars. Outside estimates are as high as $1 billion. And yet, the Maduro regime is essentially still in power. All the same people are running the country.
Shaheen said Maduro's vice president and now interim leader, Delcy Rodriguez, has not taken any steps to diminish Iranian, Chinese, or Russian influence in Venezuela, which the Trump administration said was one of the goals of ousting Maduro. The New Hampshire Democrat adds that it appears the U.S. is trading one dictator for another.
The DEA has reportedly identified Delcy Rodriguez as a significant actor in the drug trade. Do you agree with that?
Rubio said Rodriguez wasn't indicted as Maduro was, and the Trump administration's immediate goal is stability. That requires working with people the U.S. may not like.
By no means is our policy to leave in place something permanent that's as corrupt as you've described. We are in the transition and stabilization phase. We are just acknowledging reality, and that is you have to work with the people that are in charge of the elements of government.
Rubio said the U.S. is not poised to take any further military action, though he didn't rule that out entirely. Democrats questioned him about the financial arrangements, with the U.S. currently holding Venezuelan money in an account in Qatar without any congressional oversight. Senator Chris Murphy of Connecticut also asked about the deals Trump has been making.
Reports are that you've given no-bid licenses to two companies to sell Venezuela's oil. One of them is a massive donor to the president. To many Americans, that reeks.
Rubio, who was both the Secretary of State and Trump's national security advisor, said this was just a short-term fix because Venezuela was running out of storage capacity.
So we had to move that oil very quickly. The long-term plan is not those two trading companies. The long-term plan is for them to have a normal energy program that sells directly into the market.
Most Republicans praised the Trump administration's handling of Venezuela, though Kentucky Senator Rand Paul raised questions about the legality of the military operation and the precedent it sets. Rubio described it as a law enforcement operation. And as for the naval blockade, Trump's Secretary of State describes it simply as a quarantine. And he said Venezuela's current leaders are helping the U.S. identify ships to be blocked. Michelle Kellerman, NPR News, the State Department.
Drink.
Dry January. It has a different meaning for snow lovers than it does for those taking a break from alcohol. And the meaning is not good. Many places across the West are reporting their lowest snowpack ever recorded at this point in a winter. NPR's Kirk Sigler reports that has everyone from the ski industry to farmers on edge.
Where is our winter? Anxious Westerners are asking as they watch it dump snow in places that hardly ever see a flake. Continental Divide in Colorado, John Eisenbud is clicking into his ski bindings. A south-facing slope behind him is barren and brown thanks to the relentless sun.
I mean, we've known about global warming, you know, since the 80s.
He skied every winter since 1950 and has seen the changes from warming temperatures.
Oh, it's the end of the world. Thank God that Trump has assured me there's no global warming, because you can trust him.
This is a blue state where many work as federal climate scientists, and the renewable energy sector is also huge. The Trump administration is doubling down on fossil fuels and is moving to dismantle one of the biggest federal climate labs here. Ski resort managers, meanwhile, are alarmed and worried about the dry winter. In Colorado alone, the industry is an estimated $5 billion economic engine. But if you're in the business, you're always trying to be optimistic. Rob Goodell is the COO here at Loveland Ski Area.
So it has been a tough start to the season. I'd say there's no doubt about it. Our snow totals are some of the lowest we've seen in my memory.
But Loveland is maybe better off than others. The base lodge here is at 11,000 feet, so it's been cold enough to keep making artificial snow.
And then keeping the snow surface in great shape. I mean, we're standing out here right now in the sunshine, and you can hear the skiers and riders going by us. It's still very nice and soft.
From family-owned Loveland to corporate giant Vail Resorts, business is way down, though. Vail reports a 20% drop in skier visits. It's the main industry tracker from Colorado to Utah to Washington State. The Northwest and California have seen decent precipitation this winter, says University of California climate scientist Daniel Swain.
But the problem in these regions, as well, is that it's been often record warm, and so that precipitation has been falling as rain rather than snow, even at quite high elevations.
The snowpack is the West's main water supply. Tens of millions of people and countless farms rely on its storage and gradual melt into reservoirs. At the headwaters of the Colorado River, snowpack is at just 60% of average, and that average is based on the last couple decades of mega drought. Lindsay DeFrades is with the Colorado River Water District.
We saw very little precipitation. The months of November and December were some of the driest on record. If you look at the charts of snowpack, we are drawing a new bottom line, the lowest that we have ever seen.
Is this cause for alarm?
It's cause for awareness.
You may have seen some snow last weekend if you watched the AFC Championship game or the X Games in Aspen. But it was only the second snowfall here since Christmas, and DeFrades says it didn't make a dent. Tommy Nagel owns a ski shop in Keystone, Colorado, and is trying to stay upbeat.
A lot of people are wanting to learn to ski this year because it's warmer. So you're seeing a lot of people learning how to ski this year.
He's also doing a brisk repair business. The bottom of skis are getting scraped up because it's so thin and rocky. Kirk Sigler, NPR News, Denver.
Thank you for listening to All Things Considered from NPR News.
Support for NPR comes from this station. And from Easy Cater, a workplace food platform dedicated to making it easy for organizations to order food from a wide variety of restaurants, set up employee meal programs, and manage food spend at easycater.com. From the Lemelson Foundation, working to harness the power of invention and innovation to accelerate climate action and improve lives around the world. Learn more at lemelson.org. From Progressive Insurance, with Snapshot, which monitors safe driving habits to determine a personalized rate, at progressive.com. Not available in California or from all agents. and from the sustaining members of this NPR station.
It is All Things Considered here on 91.7 KAXE Grand Rapids, 90.5 KBXE Bagley Bemidji, 89.9 Brainerd, and on your smart speaker. We are People Powered Radio in northern Minnesota. Join us at KAXE.org. I'm Heidi Holton. Another hour ahead of All Things Considered. Local news with the latest Up North report coming up at 5:30. And then the news from Canada, it's as it happens. Looking like cloudy and cold tonight, 14 to 18 below, with wind chill values between 15 and 30 below zero. We receive support from the Bonner Eye Clinic, locations in Grand Rapids and Hibbing. They offer cataract surgery, LASIK, and general eye exams. BonnerEyeClinic.com. Let us help you see clearly.